This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, he's one of my favorites. And by the way, I want you to know that when we are on the subject of favorites, when I'm not kidding around, I'm serious about favorites, this guest that I'm about to introduce you to has been a favorite of mine for so long, so many years, worked together in many different capacities. And what's really neat is that she never stops being my favorite. Let me tell you who she is, and then we'll find out how long it takes her to become your favorite. When she left her daily talk show at Channel 5 in Phoenix, Arizona, which is where we are always centering these God Show conversations, wherever you are, Manila, Shanghai, Europe, around the world, it always begins here in Phoenix, Arizona. That isn't a bad beginning. And I kind of began part of my television career in Phoenix, and my partners and I were worried when she left the daily talk show that she did on Channel 5, because we were concerned. We would sit in the dressing room and say, what if she doesn't find something as good as this? Well, you know what she did? She became a major successful producer, a professional speaker around the world, a best-selling author, a former president of Arbonne, an international cosmetics firm, for 10 years, and changed that into small potatoes into big cosmetics. And you're still doing it all, aren't you? But would you right now, Rita, as we welcome you to The God Show, tell us about how it began? That, to me, is as fascinating as anything. You, your beginnings as a little girl.
Well, I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. Actually, it was Flat Rock, Tennessee, which is South Nashville. That is about as south as you can get in Nashville.
Is that up in the mountains?
No, it's not in the mountains per se, but it was just a small town. It really was at that time. It was a very small town, and I didn't have inside plumbing. I was always ashamed of where I lived. I never had anybody come to my house ever.
Why?
Well, it was. It was pitiful looking. It was something that, although I kind of was popular at school, I was president of the student body, junior high, I was captain of the cheerleaders, I had been a majorette, a color guard, but not real academic, but I was social. But, you know, I was just very, and people kind of thought that I probably had more. And one time someone came to my house, and it was a guy that I think he had a kind of crush on me, and he was on a little motor scooter, and I was out getting water. We didn't have, you know, I had to go out to the street to get water, and and we had an outhouse. Do you know what an outhouse is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I had a cousin visit us from California. When I took her to the outhouse, she said, "Well, how do you flush this?" I thought she had some problems.
Now, listen, because we could chat about anything, and there are people right now who have outdoor plumbing, and they're saying, well, no, wait a minute, hold it. I really get that. But did it have a crescent moon on the outside? I never did understand why that was a symbol.
I never did either, but it was a two-holer. But I never knew anybody else that ever came in there while you were in there. You know, I don't know why anybody would join somebody that was, you know,
but you could
on
have
one
company.
Of the holes.
You could have company.
I'd have
if
gone
wanted.
In the yard or something first before I'd have done that.
So this fella came by.
Yeah, and he looked at my house and he said, I didn't know that you lived like this. And of course I never dated that rat again, but anyway, he just, you know, made me aware. And so I kind of kept that covered up. But you know, the greatest gift, and when you are without lunch money, and I had a wonderful geography teacher, Mr. Walker, I was able to follow up with him later in life. Excuse me. But when you have a teacher that sees you have no lunch and he goes over and buys you lunch, it makes such an impression that you think, I will pay this forward. Someday I will do this for a child. And Yes. I became a social worker after college. And there's nothing worse than a social worker that was raised poor. And there's a difference in poor and poor, by the way. Poor is worse off than poor. But when you are formally raised, you know, without a lot of amenities and everything, and you're providing food and clothes and everything for children, you really are a rough social worker. And I would say to the moms, I say, I'm going to get you this check. This house has got to be clean, because I would go into some places that were just maggots in the dishes, and you can't imagine. And these children have to be fed. And I really would get after people. I took one of my assistants one time to see a house that was the worst. And I had really, you know, encouraged this woman, you've got to use this money, you know, keep these children fed and clean, and the house has to be clean. She had put, well, she had scrubbed the floors till she had rubbed the paint off. It was down to the wood. And then she had put newspaper on top of the table, so the table was all clean and the house was really straightened and everything. And my friend Judy said, Rita, this looks so good. And what I realized is that I raised this woman's expectations. You know, I was going to help her, and I did help her. But she had this; she had a role in this, too, to take care of this family. But truly, my greatest gift in life was being raised in poverty, because I couldn't appreciate what it's like to have the life I have now if I didn't know the difference. And when I interviewed Dolly Parton, she said the same thing. She said, my poverty was my gift. And I feel sorry for people that have a lot that don't know the difference, because it affects your appreciation. And the number one mental step in adjustment for prosperity is gratitude. And I am so grateful for the lessons I learned when I was in poverty of what to do later when I'm not in poverty.
Did you resent it when you looked around at the other kids, the ones that had even just a little more, much less the ones that were brought to school in those very fancy cars? Because you had a big, broad range of people, did you not?
I did.
Economically?
Yeah.
Did you resent them?
You know, that's a great question, Pat, because I think the cause of low self-esteem is when you compare yourself to anyone. Every day I wake up, I know there's somebody better looking, smarter, more prosperous, more accomplished. So what? I'm not to be compared with them, and I did not. And when I was in television, I interviewed all these famous, rich, wealthy, beautiful, talented people. I never compared myself to them, but that really does mess with a lot of people when they compare themselves to what somebody else has. Because I have a very nice home now, and I have sensed when some people have come to that home a little bit of jealousy somewhat. And it makes, in fact, I've had friends that wouldn't want to invite me to their house because my house is nicer. And when I grew up, I couldn't go to, you know, have somebody in my house because it was so pitiful. And I think that's God winking at me, see what it's like. But no, I never resented anybody that had more and accomplished more and looked better and smarter, because I didn't think God's not going to compare me to them. So I'm going to be judged by what I came here with and what I leave with and what I do with what I got. And I wish other people would learn this message, because I do see this. And Pat, I'm going to be honest, women are worse about this than men. Women have this tendency to be a little bit more jealous of each other. And that's the reason, I'll be very honest with you on the God Show. It's a good time to be honest. But I'll be very honest with you. I always had more guy friends than I did girlfriends, because there was a little bit of jealousy. I was always rocking it. I mean, I was always doing this, that, and the other. And I was a very ambitious person as a child. And I think this got in some people's way think about that, all of you listening right now. Never compare yourself to someone else, because there's always greater people or less people. Just compare yourself to where you were and where you are today and where you're headed. That's how you evaluate your success in life, I think.
You're a very successful communicator now and a very successful business person. But then, and by the way, the level of success that I'm talking about, I've been in Rita's home. It is slightly smaller than Nebraska. Beautifully appointed. And by the way, when you walk in, you do not, and I think it's really important for people to know this, because you have a lot of material things now, but when you walk into your home, you're not stunned with affluence. You are overwhelmed with affection.
Aww.
Always.
That's so sweet.
But it is absolutely true. And I'm inviting everybody in our audience from all over the world to join me in Rita's house. I'll give you the address a little bit later on, and we can all have a party. I want to go back to when you were a little girl and you were growing up without material things. You didn't have those things. You didn't have the indoor plumbing, the basics. Did you have faith? Did you have a spiritual faith when you were growing up in that family?
Yeah, I did, because we certainly went to church every Sunday. And it was a very, very strict church, by the way.
What was the denomination? Do you remember?
Church of Christ.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I remember Church of Christ. And I just always felt that I would make something out of myself. And my mother used to tell me, when I would talk about things that I wanted to do and accomplishments, and she'd say, "Don't get your hopes up. Now, don't get your hopes up." And I used to say to her, "What good are low hopes?" I mean, Success Magazine called me the hope dealer, because I have always said, keep your hopes up. I mean, why not? I mean, you've got a choice here. And I always was optimistic and hopeful, and I was positive. I was a very positive person.
Why? Why? Where did you learn that? And you also seem to be a disciplined person, as someone that audiences can depend on, showing up on time and delivering and all of those disciplines. Did you learn the discipline from that Southern faith, that Church of Christ?
Yes.
Or from your parents?
Well, my dad didn't go to church. My dad worked 6.5 days a week, and he was a brake mechanic and worked at a gas station. So he didn't go to church till later in life. My mother really knew the Bible. I could call her. She was like a theologian. And she hadn't lived a saintly life. I don't mean that, but she really didn't know the word. And so we went to church, you know, every Sunday. I used to feel like in church, though, that I could never be good enough to go to heaven, because, you know, for whatever reason, I hadn't really done that much wrong. But I didn't even get baptized until I was married. And I figured, Coach Redmond, who was my brother's track coach, he filled in for the preacher that day, and he made the whole congregation laugh. And I thought, well, the humor was so infectious. You know, I thought, this is wonderful. And I didn't know I was going to get baptized that day. In our church, you got baptized then. You didn't go home, think about it, and get all fixed up and everything. You got baptized right then.
Is that immersion?
Immersion.
Full immersion.
Immersion, yeah, yeah. And your hair gets wet and everything. You know? But anyway, I got baptized that day. And I had always believed the word. And I always felt like that getting baptized washed away your sins. And I kept thinking, well, I need to wait till I sin for something to wash away. So far, I hadn't done that much that needs to be rinsed off, you know. So I did hold back, thinking I'll do something, and then I'll need to get it, you know, a forgiveness for it. And so I did get baptized. And I keep up with Coach Redmond's wife in Nashville. She's amazing. The family's amazing. My brother was the Athlete of the Year for the state of Tennessee, and only weighed 116 pounds.
Did he run?
He ran the 440 event, and he was sickly as a child, and he was the water boy, and they needed one more participant, and there was the water boy sitting there, and my brother was a little bitty redheaded, and the assistant coach knew me, and he said, well, suit up that kid over there. We've got to have one more. We're going to get disqualified. And my brother wore a size 6 shoe. They only had an 8 track shoe, so he put on size 8 shoes. The shorts were too big. He had to hold on to the shorts. And when that gun went off, the adrenaline shot through him, and he raced. My friend said, Rita, he would have broken a world record. He would have won, you know, any championship. And the coaches looked at each other and says, why haven't we been using the water boy? He's been sitting over there on the bench. And he became Athlete of the Year, won all kinds of awards, and was my younger brother, and I adored him tremendously.
Are you proud of everybody in your family?
I am. My sister is amazing. My sister really protected me. My mother had some mental issues that caused her to be abusive. When she got older, it got okay.
I want you to tell me what that meant. I've never asked you. Uh-huh. It's a very sensitive issue. But on the God Show, we don't have any limitations as far as the subjects are concerned. Was she physically abusive?
Yes, yes. She would slap you to your nose bled. And the last time she beat my sister with a belt, so she was bleeding, because my sister's grades were not as good as the girls across the street's grades. My sister decided she would not marry, she would not beat her again. And my sister got married at 14. And she was married to a wonderful Marine. They were married 70 years. And and that kind of changed Mama a little bit about the abuse too. But we knew you were going to get physically, you know, beaten. My daddy never hit us. My daddy never laid a hand on us. But Mama would make up for it.
Didn't she discourage you also from being too ambitious?
Oh, all the time. She would just say, nobody in this family has ever graduated from high school. What makes you think that you're going to someday go to college? And I had a counselor in college and high school also that told me not to go to college. She said, Rita, you're sweet and you're right cute and you're personable. She said, find some nice boy and get married and have a family, but don't think about going on to college. And I didn't go from this counselor's advice. I didn't go to college for 2 years. And then I was dating a guy that was at Vanderbilt, and I thought, if I don't get a college education, he's going to be ashamed of me, and I'm going to drag him down, and he's going to go through life pulling on, come on, Nelly, like an old broken-down cow, and I'll let myself go and gain weight and everything. I thought, if I'm going to keep up with him, I need to get a college education. Well, I took the SATs, and I never passed them. Three times I failed my SATs. And I know y'all are really impressed to hear this, but I would get nervous, and I'd have, like, you know, a panic attack. I couldn't think. Well, I started going to night school. I worked at Woolworths, and I worked at National Life Insurance Company, and then I was going to night school at University of Tennessee, and I found out if you're an exchange student, and I was taking psychology and economics and everything at night, you don't have to pass your SATs. So I got into Middle Tennessee State University, graduated in 3 years with honors, received a BS degree, which I'm demonstrating right now, I know, but anyway, I invited my counselor to come to when I graduated, my commencement for that, and then when I was selected as a distinguished alumni, I invited my counselor to come also to hear that I got distinguished alumni after she told me not to go to college, and we remained friends forever, and I'm still friends with her daughter.
Did she ever reflect back on changing her mind in changing your life?
You know, I think she did believe, because I was not academic. What was interesting, Mrs. Dean was her name, there was a contest, a Betty Crocker Homemaker of America Award, and she was my home ec teacher, and she worked with the valedictorian of our class to win this contest because you got a scholarship. So she would have Marianne Crowell come in an hour every week to practice the test. Well, I took the test along with most of the senior girls, and when I saw Marianne Crowell later, I said, how many questions did you answer? Because she was the top student. She was a valedictorian. And she said, oh, I answered about 50 of them. And I said, why didn't you answer all of them? And she said, well, I didn't think that I needed to answer all of them. I said, well, it didn't matter how many you missed, it's how many you get right. So I had a chance. So I answered every single question. And so I told her, I said, I answered all the questions. She said, well, Rita, you didn't get them all right. And I said, well, you were not judged by how many you got right. You judged how many you got wrong. That's what set you back. I said, so it was a chance. So, of course, you got judged by, I meant to say, how many you got right. So I took a chance. Well, when I won the contest, I was in English, and I looked up, and there was the principal, and there was Mrs. Dean, and they stepped into the class and said, can we see Rita for a moment? And I walked out, and I was really scared, the principal and teacher, and I said, yes. And they said, Rita, you won the Betty Crocker Homemaker of America Award. And I'll never forget what she said. Mrs. Dean said, Rita, did you cheat? And I said, cheat? No, I don't know how I would cheat on a test. I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, we never dreamed that you would be the winner of this. And this is the principal and my teacher. And I said, well, it shows you what a person can do when they make up their mind to. And things like that taught me a great deal.
But what made you so different? Even as a little girl at home, when you were told by one of your family members not to go beyond your bringing up.
I think it was basically, Pat, was desire to protect my family and to be able to provide for them. Because I did look around. My dad had a third grade education. Mama had just maybe sixth or seventh grade education. My sister got married at 14. My brother had a lot of health problems. And I looked around and I thought, oh, my God, I have got to make something out of myself to take care of these people. That was truly 100% of my motivation. It really wasn't about me. It was about providing and protecting my family, and it still is.
Is it the same motivation you think that your friend Dolly Parton had? Because she didn't grow up well-to-do. No. She didn't grow up with grand advantages. No. But you know about her life, too. Is it the same string of ambitious movements?
I think so. And then I think with Dolly, what's great is that she had an abundance of talent. Pat, I really didn't. I couldn't sing. I couldn't dance academically. I guess that you'd say I was a C student. But what I found out is that A students usually work for B students, and the companies are usually owned by a C student. And I was more, conscious of being in the student body and captain of the cheerleaders and captain of the majorettes. I was just a social person. I love people, and I love to help people. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
But Dolly Parton never won the Betty Crocker contest.
No, she didn't. She's a neighbor of my sister's, by the way. Now.
There is a rumor, by the way, that one of the most famous people that Dolly Parton ever introduced the world to, Jolene, is just another one of your names, that you inspired Dolly Parton to write Jolene for whatever reason, and it became, of course, this massive hit.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I never knew that I was the green-eyed Jolene, and when I admit this to people or tease people, and I say, you're talking to Jolene, they don't ever look at my green eyes, Pat. They look at my flat chest, and they'll say, bless your heart. Are you serious? And so I've got some great stories. Let me tell you, I dated my husband 6 years. On our wedding night, I had worn padded bras, okay? And on our wedding night, he looked at me and he said, well, you're a lot smaller than I thought. And I looked down between his legs. I said, I was thinking the same thing.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, on The God Show, you get all of the information that our guests have to offer, and I am
I can't
delighted.
Make up stuff like this. I'm not that creative. But back to Dolly. Dolly's agent called and asked if she could be on my show, and I thought, sure, I'll work. And it kind of was when Dolly was fat and I was poor. But anyway, she came on the show, and I sent Ray Lindstrom, I hope he's listening, to pick her up at the airport.
Ray Lindstrom, a local advertising agent here in Arizona, very successful over the years in broadcasting and print.
He started the infomercial world. And because I sent him to pick up Dolly Parton at the airport and he got to spend time with her, he had me do the second infomercial ever, which I'm still grateful for. But anyway, when I was interviewing Dolly by the way, I never understood why a guitar was cut out till I saw her grab one, and then I realized why a guitar has a cutout in it. But anyway, she told me, she said, I was the only girl that Carl Dean ever dated, and that's her husband. And she said, I just always wanted to meet you. She's just really kind of cute about it. And I said, Dolly, I said, Carl Dean and I never did anything. And she said, oh, Rita, I know. She said, I was his first. And I said, oh, you are so naive. But anyway, she didn't get the joke.
How long have they been married as of now?
They've been married about 56 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And Carl's daddy was my Sunday school teacher. And Carl was voted wittiest in our senior class. And we did date. But I'm going to be honest with you. Carl smoked. And it was like kissing an ashtray if you didn't smoke. So that kind of, but Dolly smoked, so it didn't bother her. I don't know if she does now. I'm sure she doesn't. But that didn't bother her. And my mama smoked. I have to tell you the funny story. I came home from work one time, and Carl Dean and mama were sitting on the front porch smoking. And Carl Dean said, I have a $2 bill for you, Miss Mac. My mother's nickname was Miss Mac. And he said, I'm giving you this $2 bill, and I never want you to spend it because you'll never be broke. Well, that $2 bill was in my mother's Bible when she passed away, and I found it, and I put it in her casket. So the $2 bill is in my mother's casket,
wow.
So she will never be broke from Carl Dean. And Carl Dean was just precious. He was the greatest guy ever.
As long as I've known you, you seem to have always been able to embrace everybody. I remember the television studio when guests of all ages, all backgrounds, and so on, would come in to guest on your show or ours or be a part of the news. You were there with warmth, genuine enthusiasm. But you grew up in the South. Were you able to do that with people of color?
You know, I was always jealous of people with color because I'd use the self-tanner stuff, and I'd put it on one arm, and then the phone would ring, and I couldn't remember which arm I had put it on, and I'd have one dark arm and one white arm. And I really wanted to be Tina Turner. I did not want to be Rita Davenport. I wanted to be Tina Turner. And my friends that are black just have an extra gene of they're so much more fun, and they laugh more, and they're so, to me, they're just so talented. And when I was a baby, my mother had a black woman that took care of me because my mother was very ill for a while. And mother said, her name was Hattie, that I would cry for Hattie when she would go home. I loved her so much. But I look at people that have black skin, and I am jealous because it looks so beautiful to me. And I can't imagine holding. Now, I didn't go to school with anybody black until I was in college. But my former secretary was black. By the way, she still is. And I have one that was, one was Mormon, still is. One was very rich. One was almost a street person. So I don't have that gene in me.
Do you have any kind of bias problems at all with anybody? I mean, I know that you disagree mm-hmm. with some elements of political life. Mm-hmm. Certainly some of the stories that you read about in the newspaper or that you see on television, you say, wait a minute, I couldn't relate to that person. That person is fundamentally evil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've certainly been around people I don't relate to as far as their behavior, and I don't respect it or support it. But, you know, what I found out, Pat, hurt people hurt people. And when somebody mistreats me, I stop and pause, and I think, wonder what messed with them to cause them to act like this. And I feel sorry for people. I have a lot of sympathy for people. And I'm tender-hearted, and my tear ducts are attached to my bladder. People tell you that all the time. I can cry very easily. But I find good in everybody, and I look for the good. But there are a lot of evil people out there. But if anybody has ever accused me of being prejudiced, they're going to have to think something else because I don't have that in me. I mean, we all have the same color blood. And we all are exposed to so many things, and it's how we let it affect us that makes a difference in our life. I'm not going to turn my power over to somebody else to tell me not to like somebody or not, you know, mistreat somebody. That just isn't ever going to work for me. And I've had some just real experiences to teach me this, but I always had it inside of me anyway.
You have inspirational leaders that you recall either interviewing or mm-hmm. coming in contact with that moved you emotionally and spiritually?
Well, Billy Graham was, I had a chance to interview Billy Graham. Not many people got a chance to interview Billy Graham, but Richard Jackson, North Phoenix Baptist Church, was a friend of mine. He was a frequent guest on my show, and he got me that interview. And Pat, I'm always so honest with you anyway, but when I looked at Billy Graham, I was praying to God, forgive me for what I'm thinking. This was one good-looking man. I'm telling you, it wasn't like I'm going, oh, Lordy, I had no idea he was that good-looking. And I couldn't even concentrate on questions I was going to ask him because I was so distracted by, I wanted to kiss him. I mean, the man was so good-looking. But he was so moving, his presence. I thought, you know, this might not be Jesus, but it's got to be a relative because he really was powerful. And when I asked him, I said, what amazes you most about life? And I'll never forget this. And I was in my 20s when he said this. He said, the brevity of life is what amazes me. And you realize that the older you get, the more brevity there is. But you realize that we're here for such a short time and that our experiences are so amazing and we have a lot to be grateful for, and focusing more on what we're grateful for than what we're worried about is very powerful for your mind. But when he told me the brevity, and this was such an experience for me, I'll never forget getting to interview him and how good looking he was, by the way.
You've had so many opportunities to talk to so many celebrated people. And I wonder if somewhere near the top, that apex, Is there somebody that you recall thinking after you met them or just simply reading about them that you most admire?
Oh, Pat.
A male, yeah. A female, political leader, business leader, spiritual leader.
So many. I never made much materially, income-wise, in local television. Just doesn't pay that much. But you can't put a price on what it was like to interview John Wayne and interview Roy Rogers. I grew up, I had such a crush on Roy Rogers that it was, and John Wayne, that my husband today knows that I would have traded him for either one of them at any time. But to get to spend time with the people that I got to interview and ask them questions and it was amazing. Yes, it was amazing.
And when you have that opportunity, do you ever reflect back on the beginnings that we were just talking about and saying, why me? Why is it that I got out of that small town in Tennessee with a whole lot of disadvantages and I got to where I am today? On the God Show.
Yes, with Pat McMahon. Oh, my God. That is amazing. It was, Pat, I go back, even in the I had a speech impediment, by the way. And
I never knew that. All the years I've known you, mm-hmm. I had no idea. How did you overcome that?
I took a speech lesson. Somehow, somebody at school, I was in the first grade, and because we were, didn't have much money, they somehow arranged for me to go to, I just went to one class, but I was tongue-tied, and I was able to find out what I needed to do to talk better. But I got teased a lot by being tongue-tied, and then I went on to become a motivational speaker and started doing that fairly young. I was president of the student body in junior high, and I would take care of the assemblies, and I would introduce the speakers, and I would facilitate it. And it would be like 900 kids, and I was the speaker because that was the position I had. So I just like it was always in my nature that I was going to have more, be more, do more, learn more, earn more so I could share more. And I constantly thought that was going to happen. And when the woman that lived across the street from us was Miss Elliott, and there was a contest when I was in the sixth grade, and they were going to have Queen of Turner School. And you collected votes, which were a penny. And I told Miss Elliott when she was visiting Mama, she was smoking a cigarette. Mama was smoking a cigarette. I said, I'm going to be Queen of Turner School. She said, Rita, they're going to get some rich daddy's going to write a check, and nobody's going to win that. You can't win it. And I said, yes, I can. So I organized my entire class, and we went out and gathered pennies. And I won Queen of Turner School. And when Miss Elliott put the crown on my head, I kind of winked at her because when she told me there's no way you could win it, telling me I can't do something is like lighting a fire. Then I'm going to show you I can do this. And that was kind of throughout my life because I was around a lot of poverty, and Daddy had a 48 Plymouth, and the back, the floor was out, was a hole, and it was rusted out. But what was good is that when we went to see my grandmother, if you had to go potty, there was a hole in the back seat of the car, and you could just go potty right there. You had, right there. It was just a one-holer, but it was right there in the back. So, I have to tell you another great story. My grandmother was a sharecropper in Franklin, Tennessee, and had a pitiful shack and no inside plumbing, had a coal stove and everything. But this woman would come visit my grandmother. And this woman had, I didn't know what this was, but it was a limo. It was a Rolls Royce, and it was painted yellow and black. And she had a driver that was in a uniform. And this woman would be sitting in my grandmother's by the stove. And the woman had these fox furs around her. And I thought they were her pets. They were trained just to lay there on her shoulders. And I wondered why they didn't blink. I thought, I'm trying to get their attention. These foxes are laying on her shoulder. Come to find out, the woman, my grandmother's best friend, was Miss Cheek. Now, you might not know who Miss Cheek is or was. Miss Cheek owned Maxwell House Coffee Company. Sold it during the Depression for $25 million. Can you imagine what that'd be worth today? And for some reason, she loved my grandmother, and she would come and visit. And so I found out that my grandmother knew the right people. In this world, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And it's very important to you expand, but I have no idea what the connection was.
But you do know, Rita, And we're talking to Rita Davenport, businesswoman, broadcast personality, communicator, and somebody who makes me laugh all the time. You do know, you must have reflected on the fact that no matter how much money Miss Cheek made, and no matter how successful she was in that Rolls Royce, when she had to go to the bathroom, they still had to stop the car and go into a gas station somewhere, as opposed to the car your family
That's
had.
Right. I was pretty innovative, I think, to think of that, actually.
What would you do differently now, considering the number of people, Rita, that you've told us about and encouragingly, inspirationally told us that discouraged you or did not encourage you?
Uh-huh.
Is there anything that you would do differently now, considering the level of success that you've had?
Yes, I would have had more kids. I have two boys, an heir and a spare, like Princess Di. I would have liked to have had a daughter. A daughter is a daughter for life. A son is a son. He takes a wife. It's in the Bible. I should have read that part, the fine print. But I would have liked to have had more kids. There's nothing like family. I teach in my presentations, you put God first, you put family second, and you put your career third. And just bigger families. There's nothing like families. That's the reason friends are such treasures in my life, because the interaction and what you learn, you know, you truly, you become greater if you're around greater people. So you have to look at who you spend time with. And there's been people I've had to bless and release from my life because they were negative or drug me down. But I feel like the greatest gift is being able to spend time with people and learning from each other. And people are very important. So, yeah.
You have talked to us in this part of the God Show Hour about so many people that, whether you intended to or not, you showed, no, you said I couldn't do it, and I did it.
Yeah.
And you said I wouldn't pass this barrier. I wouldn't get past that barrier, and I did it. What kind of encouragement does your husband, David, provide you that those people didn't, even the ones that did help you out?
Yeah. Well, because I married the smartest person, the nicest, the best looking, whatever, I really outmarried myself. And I was concerned about the gene bank, to be honest, of having kids, because my mother and daddy were double first cousins. You know, that's illegal. That means that my grandmother was also my aunt. So if you're not into this inbreeding thing that happens sometimes, especially in the South, I laugh about that now. But I wanted... my husband was voted most shy in our senior class, and you can imagine me being considered shy, because I will talk to the wall. It's amazing. I say hi to everybody. I'm friendly. I'm outgoing. I was Miss Congeniality in two beauty contests, which meant you didn't have any talent. You were flat-chested. You were homely, but you were sweet as everything. And so I'd win these congeniality contests. But David, we've been married 57 years. And he says that, you know, it's gone so fast, it's been like 200. But anyway, he's patient. That's the one good thing. He's patient.
What do your boys think about you? What do your boys think about you as an entertainer, as a business person? What do they think about you professionally?
They're not that impressed, I'll be honest. They're both really, really smart. I mean, they got the gene bank, as I had hoped, from their daddy with the brains.
But when they're in your audience, though,
yeah, but
do they respond?
I think they're just used to it, Pat. You know, they were when they were born, I was on television. They were a guest on my show as infants. And they just never took it seriously, and I'm glad they're not. They don't take it seriously, because they just think, oh well, it's just not anything. They never had a big head about it. Never
bragged
about
it. Are they funny?
Yes, in their own way. They're not a humorist, but they are. I think they're funny.
Did they play golf?
Not much. They took it in high school, but their daddy, those of you listening, Mr. Davenport, I support his golf habit, which is a little bit like a heroin habit. He has gotten 5 hole-in-ones, and I got his butt on Augusta. I got him a chance to play on Augusta. I've had men offer me a diamond tennis bracelet or a sports car or whatever. Rita, just get me on Augusta. So that kept our marriage another 30 years.
That move, that's astounding.
I know.
And the holes in one. I mean, I knew he was a good golfer.
Five hole-in-ones, yeah.
Well, okay, so let's not talk about David's talent, because I know that David is far more interested in hearing the stories that you have to tell, even though he's heard most of them.
Yes, he has.
Maybe he has not heard the answer to this question. What part of your success do you attribute to God?
All of it. Absolutely.
But he was the one that took the plumbing away from your neighborhood and made that a part of your life. That is the two-holer that you were talking about. He caused the poverty.
Yeah.
He was responsible for you growing up the way you did without understanding when the next paycheck was going to come in.
Yeah.
So why didn't you resent that part of your life, the spiritual part of your life?
You know, I just always have known that God was watching. I have a sign over my desk that says, God is watching, give him a good show. And what I believe that our lives are, you know, laid out before we're born. I believe we're sent here with an assignment, with all the necessary skills and talent to fulfill the mission that God has sent us here to do. And I sometimes say to myself, I've got to defend this someday to God, why I didn't do more and why I didn't help more people and why I didn't make more of a difference. And because he has given me so much, so many advantages to work with. But I talk to God. Sometimes I think, God, I know you're busy, but I need to tell you this right now. He's got to be getting all kinds of messages. You know, I don't know how he can sift through all these things. But he prepared me for a life such as this, by being impoverished. Therefore, I have such an abundance of gratitude. It's just hard to even explain it, to know what it's like. I slept with my mother until I was married at 23. Mm. We had a two-bedroom house. Daddy and Ray, my brother, slept in one room. I slept with my mother. I just look back at that time, and it was to prepare me so when I wake up in the morning and I look at this beautiful bedroom that I have now, I wouldn't know the difference if I hadn't had the challenges growing up of being ashamed of where I lived.
But what in the world moved you in the direction, after all the media and the appreciative audiences, because you're an entertaining person, a lot of entertaining people, a lot of media people, who don't become the president of an international cosmetics company like Arbonne?
Okay.
How did you get from point A to point B in that short trip?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it wasn't about me. I was a speaker for this small company called Arbonne, and I had spoken for Amway and Nu Skin. I was doing like 118 speeches a year. And at the time I spoke for this company, we'd found out my brother-in-law had to have open-heart surgery, and my sister was working minimum wage at JCPenney's, and I knew they had to have help. So I told my sister about this company, and she said, I can't do that. She said, I have an eighth grade education. I have a space between my front teeth. I wear thick glasses, overweight. Nobody is going to buy anything from me. I can't sell products. And I said, every whale knows a minnow, and every minnow knows a whale. And I said, you may be a minnow in this business, but you know a whale, and that would be your sister. And I said, you sign up, and I'll show you what to do. And I knew what to do. I mean, it was a people business, and it's a numbers game. The one that wins talks to the most people, and I had taught this all over the world. And my sister said, well, okay. And she said, I tried one thing before. She had tried another company once before, but she didn't succeed. Well, she went on to become the number one income earner in this company. And for her to have a Mercedes and her to live in Brentwood, Dolly Parton's her neighbor down the street. She's actually up higher than Dolly's house. But anyway, it's a draw which one's nicer. But my sister became a rock star in the network marketing industry, because I prodded her that if anybody else can do it, and if you want it bad enough, the world steps aside for the person that knows where they're going. So either lead, follow, or get out of the way. But my whole mission to get into Arbonne was to help my sister. And then when the owner offered me the position of president, I accepted that, and we took it from about $8 million, maybe $9 million a year. It was 10 years old when I joined, up to $986 million. And it was just using these little old sayings that I would go around the country teaching, and they still work. They work.
But go back. No, go back to the time when they asked you to become the president of Arbonne. Yeah. Was that during the day? Was that at an office somewhere? And what was your immediate response? Did you actually feel secure enough to be able to say, sure, I'll handle that? Or did you think about spitting up?
No, I made sure that the owner of the company knew that I had a successful success line that people I'd sponsored. I sponsored like 35 people in one day, and I had built
with cosmetics
under my sister. I was in my sister's success line. Mm-hmm. I called it success line, not downline. But I just told him, I said, I want to always keep my success line because I may retire as a corporate position, but I want to go back in the field. And that didn't exactly work out because I was there for about 30 years. So I did retire. And my sister didn't, though. She's still now at her stage in life. She's still number two income earner.
And, wow.
Yeah, number two income earner in a company that's rocking it, doing really well.
You're one of the most sought-after speakers that I know anywhere in the country. Tell the audience about some of the speakers who have shared the stage with you.
Well, I've spoken with so many people.
Some of the familiar names.
Yeah. Well, Tony Robbins is one. And, I don't know, he doesn't care that I'm going to say this, but I would chide him about using the F word that much. I mean, I know that they do this for, reaction and everything, and they get it, and they get attention. But I spoke with Tony Robbins in Vegas one time, and I went down to get a ride to the airport, and my phone didn't work, so I couldn't get an Uber. And the driver said, are you Rita? And I said, yes. And he said, you need a ride? And I said, yes, but my phone's dead. And I thought, this is God. God sent this Uber driver right outside the door. Are you Rita? And I'm like, I can't make up stuff like this, Pat. And I said, okay. So I get in the car, and this kid that had been at Tony Robbins and heard both of us speak, he gets in the car and starts saying the F word. And I said, son, do you know what that word means? And the driver said, ma'am, I'm glad you're saying something, because I was about to say something. This was just rude, him using that word all the time. And I told him what the word meant. Do you know what it means?
Well, I think that it'd probably be more appropriate coming from a professional speaker than a humble host.
Yeah, I know. By the way, save that word. I got to say this. You're one of the smartest people, and I've known a lot of smart people, and the kindest and the most thoughtful and generous and talented that I've ever met in my entire life. That's the reason I'm here right now.
What the F are you talking about?
I know. What
the... Thank you, honey.
You know what? He could be stand-up. Could do stand-up. Who would think of that when they got such a compliment? As I was driving here today, I thought, there's no way I can edify him enough that anybody would know how much I respect and appreciate and love him so much. But anyway, I said to this kid, the F word means fornicate under the consent of the king. So back then, you had to get permission to fornicate. And I said, so it shows, when somebody uses that word, it shows a lack of vocabulary. And he paused and he said, well, I hadn't thought of that. His face changed, his expression, the aura about this kid. It was amazing to see a transformation. He got jovial, kind, funny, and he didn't use the F word another time. But the driver said, ma'am, I'm just so grateful that you did that. But anyway, I've spoken with most of John Maxwell, and I've hired, people like this to speak. Les Brown, when I joined Arbonne, the company's principles then was not to bring in outside speakers. I said, well, if you don't bring in outside speakers, you're going to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. You've got to bring in trainers, and, so I raised the bar on that. But I've spoken with so many people. It's amazing.
Rita, here's one that I hadn't planned on asking you, and most of this is spontaneous anyway, but I don't think I've ever asked you, if you would pass on to someone in our audience right now who has a little background, perhaps academically, they were invited to get up and give speeches to the student body or something, mm-hmm. and they really liked it, and they got a good reaction. What's the key to turning that into a career?
Well, right now, those of you listening, I would join National Speakers Association. I was one of the founders of that, and I'm a CSP, Certified Speaking Professional, and CPAE, which is the highest award that you can get in the industry. But they do have sessions and trainings, and if you really have a desire to be, by the way, public speaking is the number one fear in the world. The number two fear in the world is death by fire. I had a chance to have dinner one night with David Wanchinsky, and he wrote the book of List. And he said, Rita, you know you're a speaker, and it's the number one fear in the world. And I just couldn't believe that people would rather burn to death than to do a speech, because I'd been doing that since I was probably 11 or 12 years old. And but it is a terrifying thing to be a speaker. But there are some people, if you've got a message that you want to communicate and you want to set an example and you want to help people, the feedback I get from people that tell me how, I don't know if I should tell it. My friend Paula said she was going through a divorce, and she said, I would have committed suicide if I hadn't been listening to your CDs. And she said, I would listen every day. So I'm thinking, maybe this has saved lives. I hope so. But the secret of the success, and I've been grateful to be blessed this way, is I use a lot of humor. And first of all, humor, you have about a 70% better retention when you learn something while you're laughing and happy and having a good time. So actually it's 700%, but it doesn't sound very realistic, so I say 70. But it's really important. So I use a lot of humor, and I've always had that gene in me, too, to be funny.
Wait a minute, just a second. Somebody, now I'm getting a message from somebody in Farmington, New Mexico, saying, well, Rita, thank you for the advice, but I'm not funny.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens if you don't feel as if you have that talent?
Well, you act as if.
Oh.
You act as if.
Fake it till you make it?
Exactly. Because there are times, and what I have been able to do with humor to smooth out the rough edges of people that I've been around, and to make them more compatible to be with. Humor is powerful. And I think reading something funny every day, this is National Joke Day, by the way. I don't know if you know this or not, but everybody's doing jokes all over the media this morning. And so I've got a good one. I interviewed a firefighter one time on my show, and he used to go around to all the schools and teach little kids about fire safety. And if your clothes ever caught on fire, you would stop, drop, and roll. And he said he was in this first grade class teaching these kids about safety, and he said to this little boy, he said, now, Johnny, what would you do if your clothes were on fire? And Johnny said, well, sir, I wouldn't put them on. So.
Oh. That's the way to celebrate National Joke Day.
I know. I was thinking today, I thought, if Pat asked me if I have a favorite joke, I don't know why that bubbled up, but it did.
Listen. All right. So the little girl from Tennessee grew up to be the extremely attractive, terribly funny, and successful Rita Davenport on The God Show with 2.5 minutes to go.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
we haven't talked about God.
Two and a half. Oh, well, see, you did.
Oh.
No, you did, because you were providing all of that encouragement, and God just took a little time off, and he's got his feet up on a hassock now, having a glass of iced tea, while you're taking care of a little girl in North Dakota who hasn't been encouraged to do anything, has been told she's not pretty enough, that she's not really built the way that superstars should be built. So why would she consider a life in the public eye? Answer that.
Well, you got to want to, Pat. It's not for everybody. I wouldn't put this on everybody because it is stressful. But if you have a burning desire, as I did, to make a difference, not just make a living, then I think you give into that and you follow that. I definitely believe, by the way, God is a man. I was in labor with my first child for 32 hours. No woman would have done that to another woman. So God is definitely a man. And God made man first, and then he created woman, just to correct his mistakes. Now, my mama said he did like that probably because he didn't want a lot of suggestions. But I'd have had a few for him. But anyway, I feel like that everybody right now listening to this, you got to know you were sent here with a purpose and all the necessary skills and talent to fulfill that purpose. And those of you that are listening that feel good about yourself, you are on purpose. And the minute you get on purpose, it's like the whole world opens up to you. But you got to try a lot of different things. I mean, you know, I was a school teacher. I taught at Phoenix College. And the social worker, as I mentioned, I was at Arizona Public Service. That's how I got into television. And you got to follow those instincts that you have of what you need to do next. I had the idea for the Food Network, and I pitched it to my station, and they just laughed. And I said, people eat three times a day. They don't have sex that much unless they're weird, newly married, or having an affair. I said, let me tell you, Food Network would work. Well, Jack Clifford at Channel 3, he got the idea from my cooking show, and he started the Food Network. I said, Jack, you should have given me something. I wasn't making much money.
See, men,
I know.
Right?
I said, there's a book called Seed Money in Action You Give to Your Source of Inspiration. He said, yeah, I should have, because he said, I sold it for $200 million, and it's worth $3 billion today. So
her name is Rita Davenport. You don't have to wait till she comes to town as a speaker, because she has books, has television appearances, and she has my heart forever. This is The God Show. I'm Pat McMahon. Yeah.